Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and Happy New Year, everybody. I am Hercules Invictus. Welcome to Mount Olympus. Today, I'm proud to bring you yet another installment of Sword and Sandal Cinema. And before we proceed with our host, Michael Del Rossi, I will share a legend of Hercules. This one was written long ago when Yahoo groups and MSN groups were the thing. And that's where Sword and Sandal Cinema was playing out back then. Last night, while doing stretches and abs, I watched Hercules and the Princess of Troy, a 50-minute epic starring Gordon Scott that was actually the pilot for a television series that never took off. In it, Hercules, with a young Ulysses and an older Diogenes in tow, captains the sea vessel Olympia. The series was to chronicle their journeys back to Thebes, their homeland. Troy was plagued by an insectoid sea monster, to which they offered maiden sacrifices. Though Trojan warriors still challenged the creature, no one had triumphed thus far, and only one man is known to have survived the confrontation. Hercules and his crew, having defeated some pirates and freed the slaves, find out about what's going on from Trojan captives, who attempted to escape the situation at home, only to wind up enslaved and on their way to foreign markets. As with many Hercules epics, there's treachery in high places, and the fate of a kingdom hangs in the balance, with a royal lady as the pivotal point. Tetra, the regent ruler, was seemingly very caring, wise, and fair. Secretly, though, he was a scheming serpent. Only the cynical Diogenes penetrated the disguise. Afterwards, I gave voice to my inner Diogenes and contemplated the politics of my current adventures. Who stands to benefit from circumstances not changing, despite their honeyed words and public displays of support? This helped me reframe many circumstances, and I resolved to remain more alert in all future interactions. And now, without further ado, Mr. Michael Del Rossi. Greetings and welcome, Michael. How are you, sir?
Happy New Year to everyone. I hope it's a blessed New Year and one that brings good health and prosperity.
Thank you for your well wishings. I hope so, too.
I was watching one of my favorite films, which I haven't mentioned really, at least in the recent past. But before I get to that, you know, I was thinking about the cinematic genre of Sword and Sandal and its impact on me and those of my generation. And it just occurred to me that I don't think anything in cinema that I can recall ever had the impact in terms of personal achievement that Sword and Sandal films did. Their influence during the post-war years of the 60s and the explosion, the pursuit of a Greco-Roman physical ideal, I think was unparalleled as far as I know, until the 80s when, again, we had its influence somehow. I guess we could credit Arnold for that. Really, it came to the forefront of things. But prior to that, the fascination of these films faded with the 70s, really, and the disco explosion, and there was a whole different thing going on with our culture. But I think, you know, I had many times I had told my good friends, you know, I remember a lot of the Sword and Sandal films back then in the early 80s were starting to be released, as I recall, on tape, on VCR.
Yeah.
I recall that, and immediately I started to get excited and was telling my good friends that I've been waiting for this. I've been hoping and praying for this. And I would see them even in the movie stores back then, you know, the collections. And then, of course, we went to the DVDs. But I think with the advent of the movie Gladiator, I mean, they became viable again. Sword and Sandal as a whole became viable again. But the gifts of these films during the golden years, mainly, I think, the decade of the 60s, cannot be overstated. in terms of what they did for me and my friends and my associates, and cannot be overstated in terms of interest in physical culture, in terms of what they did for me personally, for my self-esteem growing up during those years. And even though they were considered, I would guess, an underground movement in terms of bodybuilding, the influence was powerful there. I think the first year I ever picked, probably, I think, about 1967. Between 1966 and 1967, I recall vividly buying my first weightlifting set from a friend. And I can tell you, the interest would have never even been there, would have never been born, had it not been for the sword and sandal epics. So for me, I don't see anything in cinema, in the history of cinema, that had the kind of impact that the sword and sandal films had, not only in terms of firing up the imagination, but in terms of physical growth and personal growth, personal improvement. How do you feel about those reflections?
Ditto, I mirror them. Sword and sandal cinema had a profound effect on me. I grew up with the myths, but it was the sword and sandal movies in popular culture and the Hercules cartoon that spoke to me, because I was born here and raised here. So the stories were the stories, and I was learning about them at home. I was learning about them in school, but these were living things. These were real people who walk the earth now. And they showed you how the spirit of long ago, the heroic spirit that faced the challenges and triumphed and changed the world. They took the world and shook the world, the Sons of Hercules, like the title song said. Yeah, that made it all very real. And I found throughout my career that in the human services especially, that a lot of folks were influenced by those movies. And one of my first Age of Heroes things that I did publicly, it got a lot of support because people had watched those movies and wanted to be with Hercules on an Argonaut adventure. So still today, as I relaunched the Age of Heroes here, it's these movies that are what feeds the spirit in people and gave them the images and the stories that inspired them.
There's absolutely no question about that. I mean, when I was growing up, we had the war films depicting the history of World War II, basically, specifically. And we had Westerns, where our major influence back in the early 60s, the late 50s and early 60s, that's what we grew up with. But it wasn't until we started attending school, of course, that we were introduced to the myths. Before that, there was really nothing. And then, of course, with the advent of film, and I guess we can point to Hercules and the original Hercules with Steve Reeves, that the influence became prominent in our lives. Then, of course, there was a whole series of films. For us, it was like, I always say, it was like the gods descending to earth, which I believe that's what that era brought to us. The gods had descended to earth. Anything that ever fired our imaginations in terms of the mythologies of Greece, specifically to life, with the sword and sandal films. So for us, it was a glorious time, a time that I don't feel cannot be duplicated. There were films that came after Gladiator, of course, Troy, and the Hercules remakes and some of the others, but it didn't really catch fire the way it did back in the 60s. It didn't catch fire. Things began to fade, I think, after Gladiator. Gladiator was a great film. I mean, I remember when me and my friend Karen went to see it in the movies. What's interesting is I'd often talk to her about my passion to see a rebirth of sword and sandal films. I had written a short story back then, the first short story I'd ever written was called The Eyes of Marcus Aurelius. I have it somewhere. So, and after I completed it, she typed it for me, and I expressed to her my strong desire to see a rebirth of this of the era. And when this Gladiator came out, we both kind of laughed, and we both got a kick out of it because I said, "Could it be? Could it be that this is?" You know, I was just beside myself. Could it be that these films will indeed experience a rebirth? And I thought Gladiator was a terrific film.
I enjoyed it too.
Yeah, I thought it was terrific. I loved the beginning of the film especially. You know, I was always a fan of, I remember back in the early 60s, there was a supermarket right across the street where we lived. I believe it was a Food Town supermarket. We lived in North New Jersey, 16th Avenue. And I went into the supermarket one day, and what do I see? We had the plastic cowboys, the Indians, the horses, but there on a rack were Roman warriors in a plastic bag and even chariots. And I couldn't wait to snatch them up, and I did. And I remember keeping them in a shoebox. We had the spearmen and the arrowmen, and we had chariots and what appeared to be Praetorian guards, all dressed in the appropriate, and they were I don't think they were hand painted, but very colorful figures. And I said to myself, you know, this this was yet another step in enlivening that passion. And I wish I had them today. Unfortunately, I'm going back many years ago, but I was so thrilled to find these figurines. And I remember I had chariots, horsemen, a complete collection. And that was all part of the thrill of being so enamored with the whole genre. I don't think there's anything in film history that can compete with what the sword and sandal era brought to us in terms of not only, again, firing up our imaginations and inciting our interest in the Greek mythologies and everything that they brought to us. And they brought so many, the mythologies brought so much to us. But or what they did for us as far as personal growth, there was a personal growth aspect to being passionate about these films. And for me, there'll never be anything like it. And those are my impressions I wanted to share with you this evening.
Well, thank you. I still live in those movies to a great extent, and I have something I do called Myth Adventure, and I run the Tale of the Argo, the Labors of Hercules, the Capture of Pegasus, you know, different stories with kids, and I'm always on the lookout for figures like the ones you're describing. I have crates full of them. And I use them in the story with maps, and so the kids get to live out the myths. And they're not familiar with the old movies that we grew up with, but they have Percy Jackson, you know, which was made into films and games, and there's a series of books, I think there's like 15 of them. So they have other things that teach them about the mythology. But the same yearning to be heroes and to accomplish great deeds and to fight monsters, that's still very much part of people. And I've run these things for adults as well, and the adults really love them, you know, because they get to be these figures from the movies. You know, they get to be Hercules, and they get to be Atlas, and they get to be, you know, anyone from other characters. So I try to keep it alive in that way. And I've been doing it for decades. This is, I think, the third or fourth time we've done the Argonaut voyage. And like the Argonaut voyage in myths, it took over like 2.5 years to get there with the Golden Fleece in the activity too.
Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, where does all this take place? How to explain to me the construct of all of this?
Well, I've done it in libraries. I've done it in community colleges, in literacy programs, and in after school enrichment programs for kids and STEAM programs, which is science, technology, engineering, art, and mathematics. So right now it's going to be running in two schools or three schools and in groups in people's homes. It's starting in February. And then I do things, as you know, I have all these podcasts, and I have right now I have a new group starting the library tomorrow. It's going to deal with esoteric wisdom from antiquity, where the myths were used to express deeper truths, you know, deeper philosophical and metaphysical truths. So, again, that's my playground. I don't have to wonder about a paradise of Greek mythology. I'm living in one.
And that's wonderful. That's wonderful. What a way to enhance your life and enhance every part of your artistic self, your creative self, and those that are exposed to these things. But you mentioned something about the figurines. You have figurines?
Oh, I have plastic bins full of figurines. I'm always on the lookout for them, and I look for them. I just got a dozen more. Fortunately, I scarfed them up when they were cheap. Now they're like $6, $7 each. I got them for like $1, $1.99 when they first came out on Amazon. I'm always looking for Greek mythology figures. I have centaurs and satyrs and cyclopses and, you know, name it, dryads and naiads and oreads.
So you've got most of these. You've been able to obtain them on the internet?
Yeah, some of them, I've collected them as I've moved through life. So I've accumulated most of them. They're very hard to find, but I still use maps from like 20, 25 years ago, you know, because that's when they made the map, you know, and I still have it. Some of them are well-worn, but some of them are brand new. Like now they're making, they resist water and they're more exact in their drawing, you know, more lifelike. A lot of people play fantasy role-playing games like Dungeons and Dragons. So every now and then they'll start making figurines for people who play that. So I just try to, I miss a lot because they're made all over the planet. I do have a lot of them. I have, 20 figurines of Hercules alone.
I'm going to have to bring myself up to speed because I do have some figurines here somewhere. Karen did buy me some for, I think it might have been for Christmas, going back a few years, mostly of Roman figurines.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're hand-painted. I know I have them somewhere, but I've moved twice since December, so I'm still trying to get some of my collector's items together, if you will. But it's been a while. It's been a while, so, you know, you describing that captured my imagination because I haven't really been looking for them lately. I think I'm going to start doing that again.
Sometimes companies will send me things because I talk about the subject all the time, so they send things in the hope that I'll like them and talk about them. I think in the past year I got Amazons and Centaur figures. They were a little bit larger than the ones I normally use, but they're really excellent products. And of course, I have to incorporate them into my stories as quickly as I can.
That's great. Well, I'm going to have to bring myself up to speed on that. I haven't been looking in a while, but I love my figurines. I love them. And like I say, as I said, going way back when I first saw them in the early 60s, it had to be around, I'd say, 65, maybe 66. I'm certainly betraying my age here. But to see them and to find them in the supermarket like that, because I just never thought I would, because again, it was, you know, that was the beginning of things, you know, in terms of sword and sandal popularity. And it was the beginning of things. And you found plenty of cowboys and Indians and those types of figurines. But I never in my wildest dreams thought I'd find chariots and Romans and arrowmen and gladiators and spearmen. And I can assure you, when I did, I was just beside myself back in those years. I wish I had it now, but it was a great
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I want to hear what you have to say.
I used to run a game in a homeless shelter. And the kids loved it, you know, with the mythology and with the figurines and the, you know, the scenery and because I'd assemble like something and then they play on that, and then if they moved somewhere else on the map, I'd have to reassemble and so forth. One of the counselors there told me that the kids had been talking about in school, and kids who weren't homeless. Thought that the kids who were homeless were lucky because they got to fight dragons and creatures.
that's a great story. You know, I wanted to ask you a question, too, about the film you were just describing, Hercules and the Princess of Troy.
Yes.
Do you know why that never matured in terms of a television series? Do you know what happened with that? I did see the film once, and I did read that it was, you know, being groomed for a series that never materialized, obviously. Do you know what happened with that, why there was no follow-through?
I've heard several stories. What I remember, they were going to originally have Steve Reeves, but Joseph Levine was doing what he normally did with Steve Reeves and telling him he could easily be replaced and things like that. Steve Reeves turned it down. So they got Gordon Scott, and it just didn't catch on. That was the pilot for the television show, but it never went anywhere. The third Hercules movie, which they were also going to make, Hercules Against the Gods, I think it was called, same thing. Steve Reeves at that time was one of the most well-paid actors on the planet, and Joseph Levine, who felt that he wouldn't have his fame if it weren't for him, and that is very true to a large extent, didn't want to pay him, so that didn't get made.
I did not know that. So there was a third Hercules film in the works.
Yes, there was a third Hercules film. It was still, I think, in the very early stages, but it was going to be a trilogy, and it just never happened. So they worked on the television show, and that never happened. But we got the pilot.
That's unfortunate. Did Joseph E. Levine have a history of this in terms of his relationship with Steve Reeves?
From what I understand of their relationship, yes, it opened the door to a lot of opportunity and created a global phenomenon. He was very frugal and didn't like paying people what they were actually worth. It was they should be grateful to him for what he did, and they shouldn't take as much money as they thought they needed. So he would always tell Steve Reeves other actors that could do just as good as him.
Oh, I didn't know that. I learned this history from you. I was not aware of that.
It's been years since I heard these stories, so I might not be remembering correctly, but that was the gist of it.
Mm-hmm. That was I would imagine. I mean, this is true of my experience, but I'm interested to know. Was it Hercules? Was that the first sword and sandal film you had ever seen, or was there had you been exposed to the genre before this? What was your history with this?
Well, I was born in '59, so I was born the year it came out here in the United States. I think it was made in '57 or '58, and then it came out here in '59. I caught it in the '60s on television.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And then when I was in Europe, I got to see it on the screen, you know, because there it was still playing on the screen. Here it was playing on the our small black and white TV, and that's how I got introduced to it. And again, I've heard the stories, and I was able to identify the myths that they kind of switched around a little bit to put inside the story. Last night, actually, I had a dream that I was wearing that bear outfit that he had in the first movie. So.
That's great.
But, I had heard of him at the same time I heard of the other stars who had filmed in the early 60s, and then got syndication deals during my childhood.
Mm-hmm.
I watched all those on TV mostly, and occasionally in the movie theaters. So that was my exposure to it. And I knew we had family in Greece, and as a young kid, I thought that the people in Greece still dressed that way. And I was very disappointed when my grandparents visited that they weren't wearing these sword and sandal costumes when they came over.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. I remember prior to the Sons of Hercules series, WOR TV here in New York, prior to the Sons of Hercules, it was Saturday nights, and I forget the title of the program, some heroes, something or other. I wish I could remember. But that's where I was first introduced to the Hercules film with Steve Reeves, and then subsequently Hercules Unchained. And in the beginning of the show, they would show different cuts, if you will, of different films, different. And I forget the title of it. I wish I could remember. I can't. But every Saturday night, there would be a sword and sandal epic. And the whole thing began with Hercules and then Hercules Unchained. Do you remember that?
I remember.
I know.
That.
Yes. It was WOR.
Yes, on WOR. I just looked at the clock. We have like 3 minutes left. Time zoomed by, as it always does. How can people find you? How can they follow you? And how can they get involved with all the great things that you do?
To me, at Michael DeRossi, Post Office Box 129, Caldwell, New Jersey, 07006. I do a focused prayer work for everyone, and I will write them back. And I also have a creative health manual, which I feel provides a firm foundation for natural healing. I cover everything in there, supplements, diets, the sugar diseases, heart disease. It's all there. It's a handsome package, if I do say so myself. And that's $3 a copy. Check a money order to the same, up to Michael DeRossi, P.O. Box 129, Caldwell, New Jersey. So that's basically what I'm doing. Thank you for asking. And I really enjoyed my time on the air this evening.
Yes, I enjoy our time together very much. I wish there was more time to spend. Michael also has a show, Herculean Physique, where his philosophy, bold spirits, holistic concepts is expressed. And you can find out about all the wonderful research he's doing with food supplementation. And I always learn from it. And soon Michael will be on our UFO shows on a regular basis as well, because he has a lot of experience with that.
I'm excited, and I'm certainly looking forward to it. And we're all pleased that you provided us with the opportunity.
Thank you, Michael. Happy New Year, and I will talk to you very soon.
Thank you. Happy New Year to everyone.
Now I'm going to do another legend of Hercules, and then we will start the second part of our show. Since Plato first penned his foundational works, many a tale teller has spun a fantastic yarn of long ago times and set it in ancient Atlantis. One of the most recent was a television series that explored the lost continent through the lens of Greek mythology. Epic heroes like Jason and Hercules, along with historical figures like Pythagoras, pronounced Pythagoras in the show, adventure in a land not unlike Minoan Crete, and revisit the classical legends. Though unseen, Poseidon is an all-powerful presence. Alas, the series was not renewed for a third season, which is unfortunate, as it was leading to the Voyage of the Argo, one of my favorite myths. But the two-season adventure is now immortalized on Blu-ray, DVD, and on streaming on television. Right now we're reviewing season one, and today we're going to focus on episodes 5 and 6. Episode 5, White Lies. Theros, Minos's son, thought to be a traitor and long dead, returns to Atlantis. The intricate schemes of the royal house spanning many years are revealed. Heptarion is further revealed to be Pasiphae's creature. Hercules' feelings for Medusa and the bond between Jason and Ariadne grow even stronger. Episode 6, The Song of the Sirens. Insecure about himself and his future with Medusa, Hercules seeks the help of the Colchian witch Medusa. A potion he is given reveals the depths of Medusa's love, but poisons her. Hercules confronts Circe, who turns him into a pig. Jason and Pythagoras seek the witch. She reveals herself to be Pasiphae's sister, and Jason reluctantly agrees to be the instrument of her vengeance if she restores his friends to their earlier conditions. Hercules and Medusa become estranged because of this. Dun, dun, dun. To be continued in a future episode. And now our host for segment two, Michael K. Waterman, better known as Setna of Kemet. Greetings and welcome, Setna. How are you?
Life, health, and prosperity, and happy new year all. I'm well. I've had quite a great day. I'm so glad to speak to all of you.
And we're glad to have you here, and I'm looking forward to the movie that you're going to be focusing on today. I remember watching it long ago, and then again long after that, and it's been a long time since I last saw it, but you bring back happy memories of this epic.
I'm watching it right now. I won't spoil it. It is a Technicolor fantasy. It's beautiful. It is magical. You have every element that you could possibly want in it. You have two lovers, of course. He's a queen, a king, and she's a princess, of course. You have an evil wizard. You have the thief himself, played by none other than Sabu, who was a little Indian boy, who is the basis of Mowgli in the Jungle Book.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. They say that the Jungle Book was written by Rudyard Kipling, and it was. But Rudyard Kipling had heard about Sabu, who was a boy who was raised not by apes, but by wolves. And in India, I believe near the Punjab, which is in the north of India, and Sabu was brought to Hollywood. They cut his hair. They cleaned him up. I think the whole thing's a lot of baloney, honestly, because he speaks English far too well. But he is a mischievous, wonderful actor. The movie is unbelievable. The colors, the pictures are just right out of a storybook. It's very beautiful. You also have he's a 90 or 100 foot genie, who is very much like the beginning of the genie in the play and the movie Aladdin.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the prototype. He has a long top knot that goes down his back. He's black. He has great big eyebrows, and he laughs, and he's very mischievous. Abu, who is Babu, finds him on the beach when the evil wizard knocks him and Ahmed, who is the king, off their boat because they're trying to rescue the princess from this evil wizard. It starts in the beginning with the wizard and the girl on the boat. She's asleep. And then they go back. It's sort of a flashback to how this all happened. And Ahmed is a king, and the evil wizard, whose name is Jafar, destroys him. He was going to have him killed, and he puts him in jail. And Ahmed has lost his mind, he thinks. And little Sabu, who is Abu, is arrested for stealing bread, and he's thrown into jail. And they're going to cut it into about 8 pieces. And meanwhile, he steals the keys to the jail. And he takes Ahmed on a journey. And he ends up in Basra. Well, when he gets to Basra, because they're from Baghdad, when he gets to Basra, Ahmed sees this beautiful princess who kind of looks like Dorothy L'Amour. She's a beautiful young lady. And he falls in love with her. The funny thing is all the other characters in the play, movie are wonderful, but you really watch Sabu more than anybody else. He's very interesting. He's animated. everybody else is kind of in the background, except for the wizard who plays this Jafar, who's a classic evil wizard, right down to his greasy mustache.
If I remember correctly, the genie has toenails or fingernails that need to be attended.
They're gigantic yellow pointed toenails and fingernails, and he has pointed ears. And if you look at him really well, as a makeup artist, I'm like, oh, come on. His makeup is kind of greenish, but they leave the rest of him natural, which didn't make any sense to me. They didn't have airbrush back then. Even Margaret Hamilton, the Wicked Witch of the West, was painted by hand, that awful, weird green that she was. And the poor Tin Man, Jack Haley, got very sick. And so, as you know, Buddy Ebsen was the original Tin Man in The Wizard of Oz, and he was allergic to the silver paint, the silver makeup they put on him. And he lost the role. Haley, who was a great dancer, and took the role, and he was fine with the makeup, so that was okay. But getting back to The Thief of Baghdad, so you have every infant. You've got flying carpets, you've got magic horses, you've got a very evil silver maiden who kills the princess's father. He says to her when she escapes Jafar, you never have to go back to him as long as I'm alive. Well, the king has a thing for toys. You remember that, Hercules?
Vaguely. It's been a very long time since I've seen it.
He loves toys. And that's how Jafar kills him. Jafar, he shows the king, the evil wizard, all his toys. And Jafar says originally, I got something better for you. And what he's got, he assembles for him, is an amazing flying horse. It's kind of like the horse from The Wizard of Oz, the horse of a different color. Well, this one, you ride him and he flies through the air. And anyway.
Remember that.
The king says, I've got to have this horse. And Jafar says, fine, you can have whatever you want, but I want your daughter. And the king goes, well, you know, whatever. Okay, you can have my daughter. And, of course, the daughter has nothing to do with it. She escapes. There's a dialogue I saw while she's on the boat. Jafar finds her. She was going to Samarkand to live to escape with her sister. But on the road to Samarkand, which is the Silk Road, if you think about it, she's captured. And she's sold into a slave market. And meanwhile, Jafar saves her. So she's on this Bagala, which is in India, an Arabic boat. And by the way, let's get into that. This whole story is one of the stories told by Scheherazade.
Yes.
To King, right. It's from the Arabian Nights.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, amazing tale, 1001 Arabian Nights. And this is one of the most wonderful tales. Also, Ali Baba and Aladdin and all these other amazing stories are told. This one is just so romantic and beautiful. I haven't seen the movie in about 3 or 4 years, and I was curious about it. So I watched it Saturday after work. Friday. And I thought, okay, I want to see this again. The music and the movie, the colors in it are so beautiful. And it just takes you back to your childhood. And that's the whole thing. It's a fantasy. And, you know, sometimes we need this, don't we? To, like, take ourselves out of ourselves, put us back into a time of innocence and a time of, you know, carefreeness. I mean, we've all got responsibilities now. And, you know, we got to pay bills and taxes and go to work and what have you. This movie is complete escapism. You're going into a realm of Arabian fantasy. Well, if you think about it, actually Indian fantasy, because Scheherazade is really the queen, Shah Jahan's wife, Das Mahal, who was the Taj Mahal is built for. Das Mahal told Shah Jahan, stories, 1001 stories, and 3 years worth of stories. He was going to, you know the story about Shah Jahan, don't you? He had a wife who was very, very unfaithful to everybody in the kingdom, and so he cut her head off. This is what kings back in those days did.
What
he did was every night he would meet a new bride, make love to her, and the next day he cut her head off. And this went on for a long time. And finally, they were running out of, you know, virgin maidens. So, I mean, how many do you have in the kingdom, right? So the grand vizier said, I have a beautiful daughter. And her name is Scheherazade, but it's really Das Mohav. And the king says, well, all right, I'll take her. I'm sorry, but I'm going to cut her head off tomorrow morning. So meanwhile, she's sitting in his harem, and she's telling stories. Well, the king walks in, and she starts talking, and he is fascinated. And she's telling the story. And then the sun's coming up, and he says, well, I've got to go get ready because I'm going to be beheaded in about an hour. So I have to stop. He goes, no. Tell me, finish the story. And he, you know, postpone your execution. So she starts the next story and the next one. And meanwhile, he falls in love with her. And she actually falls in love with him. Shah Jahan and Das Mohal had 22 children.
Mm-hmm.
I believe she died of being a mother. But he built... His love for her was unbelievable, and he built for her the Taj Mahal. And this is the background to the story I'm telling. And, you know,
wow.
this woman was a phenomenal storyteller. I mean, enough where she made her husband, who he was going to kill her, fall in love with her and make him realize what he thought what he did was terrible and stupid. And that, oh, my God, you know, here, this is a beautiful girl giving me her life. And he did, and she did. She gave up her life, family, to be with him. And she thought she'd be beheaded. And what happened was they fell in love, and they had a long, wonderful relationship. So that was where this story comes from. And I think it's the third or the fourth story that she told him. And it's about a love that's lost, a love that's found, and a love that lasts forever. And they make poor in the end of it. In the end of the story, Ahmed is reunited with Abu. The genie takes him to a temple where there's a gigantic, I guess she's a bodhisattva, and it's a goddess.
Mm-hmm.
And the goddess has in the middle of her forehead a humongous ruby. And the ruby is called the all-seeing eye. And Abu wants to see where Ahmed is. Ahmed's lost somewhere. So the genie says, the only way you're going to get this to see where he is look into this all-seeing eye. And Ahmed says he never wants to see him again, blah, 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 blah. And Ahmed smashes the statue, the eye, and Ahmed disappears. The energy. So now Abu is stuck on top of this mountain. The genie says, I'm giving you your three wishes. Goodbye. And off he goes. So Ahmed yells and screams, Abu yells and screams, and he's carrying on, and he's yelling so loud he's caused an avalanche, and he's on this gigantic slab of, I guess, sandstone, and he's hurtling into this base, and somewhere along the line he lands somewhere, and it's called the Land of Dreams. And what happens is this king says, you are now the king. You have landed here. We've been waiting for you for 1,000 years. It's always 1,000 years. You ever notice that? We've been waiting for you for 1,000 years. And here you are, little prince. You can have everything in our whole kingdom. This is your magic bow and arrow. And the only thing I wish you not to touch, and you know, this guy's a thief, right, is this magic carpet in which I want to go into the next life with. So Ahmed is... Now, somewhere, he's going to definitely be headed, and that's what Abu sees. And the princess is being held prisoner, and she's also going to be beheaded by this evil Jafar, because he realizes their love, he can't interfere with it. No matter what he's done, they'll always love each other. So that's not going to work for him. He's like, you know, if I can't have this damn princess, I'll kill both of them.
Mm.
So that's where Abu says, oh, my God, what am I going to do? And he says to Allah, listen, I'm going to steal this carpet. I'll give it back to the king, but he doesn't need that to go to heaven. You can lift him in your gentle hands and take him up into the heavens. So there's a prophecy in the movie about a boy flying on a cloud who's going to end and kill this evil villain. Well, they all thought it was King Ahmed, but it's really Jafar, who's a real creep.
Uh-huh.
What happens in the movie is that Jafar, after he's killed the king and he's the princess's father, he's going to escape. He sees that Abu, who's flying on this magic carpet with his arrow, this bow and arrow thing, has now shot the executioner, who's about to chop off Ahmed's head. And he says, oh, shit, I can't do this. So he runs, gets on the magic flying horse, going to escape, he thinks. Well, Ahmed and Abu jump on the magic carpet, and Abu gives Ahmed the magic bow and arrow, and he shoots, well, it's really, I guess, a crossbow, and he shoots into the air, and the Grand Vizier, the evil wizard, gets it right between the eyes. Bang! And he immediately, you know, grabs his head like he's going to die, and the horse he's flying on falls apart. It's that, you know, the whole song from Patsy Cline, I Fall to Pieces. And that's what happens. The horse the horse falls into like five or six pieces. The Grand Vizier ends up in the middle of, I guess, the Indian Ocean. And that's the end of him. Ahmed and the princess, who's now the queen, are reunited. And they're going to, poor little Abu, he's the hero and they love him. And they're going to put him into school. And he's all of a sudden, this is a kid running around in a loincloth the whole show. They put him in this beautiful Indian outfit, and he feels he's got a tight neck line, and he's wearing a turban and a feather and the whole nine, and he's very uncomfortable. This is a thief, a guy that's been free his whole life, living by his wits and his ability to steal things, and now all of a sudden he has to settle down. Well, that's not going to work for him. So what happens is he jumps back on the magic carpet, and he flies. They said, where are you going? He goes, I don't know, but I've been taking care of everybody else. No, I want to have some fun. And he flies off into the distance of Steve. And the king, of course, kisses the princess because that's how that kind of thing happens. There's a big orchestration. There's beautiful music. And all, you know, and then you have the, and they live happily ever after. So it's a beautiful movie. I recommend it to everyone. If you just want to escape, there are some very scary moments. In order for Abu to get that all-seeing eye, he has to enter the inside of the statue to climb up. Well, unfortunately for Abu, in the middle of the statue, you remember Hercules as a kid? This is almost as scary as the Wicked Witch and the Crystal Ball. Abu had this gigantic spider, and he's in the spider web, and there's skulls and skeletons. All over the place. And Abu only has, he finds in one of the skeleton's hands a saber, because of course it's the Middle East, India or whatever, Arabia, and he has a saber, because that's what they had, a scimitar. I think that's the word, right, scimitar?
Yes, I believe so.
So
the curved
it's
knife.
Big wide curved blade, which is a scimitar. And the spider is coming at him, and it's a big scary looking sort of tarantula Black Widow mix, I don't know, and it's ugly as hell. And when I was a little boy, it frightened the hell out of me. It really did. And you're watching it, well, on TV, but this thing is coming at you. So he cuts the spider comes out, and he cuts the spider web, and for some reason or other, underneath the spider web, there's a big pool. And what's in the pool? Crocodiles, of course. What else would you have in a Middle Eastern pool?
it seems that there's a lot of anachronisms and weird things, but it's a fable, so I guess it's okay.
Yeah, so you know, you got a pool full of crocodiles in the belly of a goddess. What does that say about certain goddesses? A belly? I don't know what she's been eating, but she's got crocodiles in there. Other people have, you know, Acidophilus and you know all kinds of flora and fauna in their stomachs that kind of help with digestion. But this one's got crocodiles. I don't know. I don't know where that came from, but that's what happens. Something that the producer thought was kind of cute and scary. So he cuts the spider, and the spider falls into the crocodiles. Oh, there's an octopus, too. I forgot about that.
Okay.
And the crocodiles and the octopus kill the spider. I guess there's enough for everybody. Kind of the spider feast for the crocodiles and the octopus. And somehow the octopus doesn't eat or vice versa. So they don't eat each other. They're kind of friends. I don't know how that happens, but okay, fine. And then, like I said, he gets the all-seeing eye. He finds where Ahmed is. He gets to Ahmed. Ahmed yells at him, and they smash the eye and the whole nine yards. And the ending is cute because you've got everybody happy except, of course, Jafar, who now has an arrow between his eyebrows. So, boing! And that's the end of him.
That's where
everybody. Well, yeah, we're back in Baghdad. I guess the rest of it took place in Basra. And everybody's happy. The king, the people who hated Ahmed suddenly realized it was Jafar they hate, and they love the king. He rescues the princess, and then Abus rescues the king, and everybody's all happy and carrying on and whatever. And the adventure is over, but not for Abu, because he gets on the flying carpet, and he flies off into the sunset. And it's a cute, funny, dreamy looking, beautiful movie. The makeup is very much the period. He has on a terrible, greasy looking wig, I gotta say. And he's very skinny. He's not my idea of you. He's not a Hercules. Okay, he's not a hero. He's a skinny little guy. He's kind of built like Gilligan.
Okay.
But he's a hero, and he's got kind of a nice looking face. I think he's wearing too much eyeshadow and too much eyeliner, but that's a makeup artist's view. And after all, that's what I do. And I looked at him and I thought, you know, but Sabu doesn't really have much makeup on at all. In fact, if he does at all, he has maybe some bronzer, well, from my Long Island bronzer, you know. And he looks very natural, and he's a very, very animated, very wonderful character. And I really had a good time. And I think anybody who watches this movie, you know, watch it, giggle, remember when you watch it the first time, and enjoy it. It's a real fun, almost a Ray Harryhausen kind of a thing with the spider and the whole nine yards.
Mm-hmm.
Hercules, Ray Harryhausen's fantasy movies are some of my favorites, and I know some of yours. Oh, yeah. So this is something I want people to go see again. I found it on Prime, Amazon Prime, and I've also found it on Tubi. So you can have it with commercials or without. And the one with Amazon Prime is a bit longer, and it's not as cut up, and you'll understand the story more, I think. If you're cheap and you want to do it on Tubi, you can. You can rent it also for, I think it's $3, or you can buy it for $9. But
okay.
I think, you know, watching it on Prime, on Amazon Prime, is really good, Prime Video. And it was a great thing to see again. I remember it being on Channel 9, WOR, which I didn't know back in those days was from Newark, or Secaucus. How do you say Secaucus? You know, I'm from Long Island. I say Secaucus. I don't know. And,
I live in the Bronx, so...
I grew up in Uniondale, Long Island, which is the home of
wow.
Astra College and Nassau Community College. And also, it's one of the fields that Lindbergh took off in. You know, a Roosevelt Field. There's a shopping mall there now, but that whole area is where Lindbergh took off.
I did not know
you
that.
Know, the Wright brothers took off from Kitty Hawk, but Lindbergh took off from Long Island. Long Island.
There we go.
And I'm very proud of where I grew up. Uniondale is a magical, wonderful place. There's a lot of magical organizations, I'll be nice, groves, covens, what have you, that were in the area when I was growing up. And I found out my family was part of that, so... But, you know, that's for another discussion, for another time. But I learned a lot about wizardry, shall we say, firsthand, as you know.
And on Thursday, you have your show, your Mages, Sages, and Seers show, which we'll be renaming in the near future. So we get to see the wizardly part of you as well.
Exactly. But right now I'm just being a fun film critic. And I really recommend this to everybody. It is a delightful fantasy. And, you know, you don't go in this looking at it for reality. There's nothing real about it. The colors are, you know, fuchsias, pinks, purples. Everything looks like something out of Jones Beach Theater in Long Island. Wild avocado, crazy colors. Kind of like what Oz looked like in The Wizard of Oz. This is a year later. The Wizard of Oz was 1939, and this movie is 1940. So I suspect it's also hand-painted. It has that look. You know, it's very old-fashioned Hollywood, and it's just beautiful, glamorous, and, you know, a wonderful fantasy. It's nothing to be taken seriously with. It's something to have a good ball, a good time, and just enjoy. And just drink it in. It's very much indicative of the 1940s. The costumes, I think the girls' costumes, the guys, I don't think anybody's wearing the fantasy things the guys were wearing. But the women's dresses, I think, like Cleopatra in 1960 affected fashion, I think that the Thief of Baghdad's, the women's costumes affected fashion also. There's things in their hair. The way the dresses are done were, I think, brought into couture and then brought into ready-to-wear.
That is very interesting. And we're down to our last 3 minutes again. That seems to be the magic number where I look up and notice the time. How can Setna people find you? How can they follow you? How can they... contact you? How can they enter your world?
I have Michael Waterman has three Facebook accounts. I have them with my artwork. I have with my wishniks, my trolls called Pookie and Friends.
Okay.
Michael K. Waterman. And you have my art and Michael's art and more. You can get me on Instagram, MK Waterman, I think it is. Look it up. You'll just put my name, my full name, Michael K. Waterman, and you'll find me on Instagram. You can get me on my phone, 516-650-3691. You can reach me through Hercules if you wish. And mostly Facebook is the easiest way. Or phone a wizard also. That's my other Facebook page, and that's where I do tarot and divination and various forms of metaphysical artwork or metaphysical work. And I think that's about the only way. That's about it. So Facebook, Instagram, my phone number, my mkwaterman@icloud.com, and you and Hercules.
Thank you. And I'm looking forward to speaking with you again in 2 days.
Yeah. And I want to wish a happy new year. And all I can say to you is I am so grateful to Hercules for the opportunities he gives me. This is a man who really is a hero. He is a wonderful, wonderful person. And I'm glad all of you are listening.
Thank you for your kind words again, my friend. And thanks to all for listening. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. Thanks again, Seth, and I will talk to you very, very soon.
All right. Good night, Hercules. Good night, everybody.
Good night.